This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Last March, as Broadway was shutting down in response to the pandemic, COVID-19 spread through the cast of the musical Moulin Rouge, infecting one of the show's stars, our guest Danny Burstein, with a particularly severe case. He had to be hospitalized, and there were times when he thought he would die. When he returned home, his wife, Rebecca Luker, also a Broadway star, came down with COVID. Her case was relatively mild, but it was on top of having been diagnosed a few months earlier with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, a progressive disease that affects nerve cells in the brain and spinal cord, causing loss of muscle control, which can make it increasingly difficult to move, speak, or breathe. Rebecca Luker and Danny Burstein spoke with Terry on Monday, and they began with some recordings for which each received Tony nominations. First, we'll hear Rebecca Luker as Maria in the 1998 revival of The Sound of Music, then Danny Burstein as Tevye in the 2015 revival of Fiddler on the Roof.
To beat like the wings of the birds that rise from the lake to the trees.
If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, yiddle, diddle, deedle, diddle, man, I see my wife, my golden, looking like a rich man's wife with a proper double chin, supervising meals to her heart's delight. I see her putting on airs and strutting like a peacock. Hey, what a happy mood she's in, screaming at the servants day and night.
Rebecca Luker, Danny Burstein, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've both been on our show several times. It's a pleasure to have you back. I'm so sorry about all the medical problems you've been having, and I know it's been a rough time. So you've both had COVID, so I want to start with that. I'd like to hear your reaction to President Trump's message that it was a blessing from God that he caught COVID. He said that the remdesivir, the antiviral medication he was given, which doesn't have government approval yet, was a cure. When a lot of people are saying, a lot of medical experts are saying, if anything helped him, it was probably the dexamethasone. And the president urged people not to be afraid of COVID and said he felt better than he did 20 years ago. So what was your reaction to hearing that?
Well, you would think that someone who went through such a traumatic experience would have learned something from such a difficult experience. Also, he had the best doctors in the world and the newest medications. When I went in at the beginning of March, I happened to be in a room next to the nurse's station, and there were literally people dying all around me. I was very sick. I was in the hospital for about a week. And I heard when people needed to be intubated, when they needed to be put on respirators, when they were rushed to the ICU, when they died in their rooms. My roommate almost died a couple of times. I literally had to rip off my own oxygen to run to the door to get the nurses in there because he couldn't breathe. And the idea that someone thinks that this is a blessing from God is just
absurd.
It's absurd. It's a perversion of reality. And I'm sorry that he was sick, and I'm sorry so many people in the government have gotten sick from it. But I truly wish they had actually learned something, that it's a very dangerous thing and it should not be toyed with. It should not be treated lightly. And to brush it off as nothing, as, you know, as now he feels better after having had it, is just the slap in the face and such an insult to not only everyone who has passed away, but everyone who's gotten it and has suffered and is still suffering, like myself, with residual issues.
Yeah, you said you had residual effects from the COVID. What are they?
I have a lot of swelling in my hands. I get very lethargic. And that's mostly what's left of it. But it took my lungs months before I could walk a couple of blocks outside. My lungs, I had double COVID pneumonia in both my lungs. And they showed me my chest x-ray 5 weeks after I came out of the hospital initially. And I had they were all white. On a normal chest x-ray, your lungs are supposed to look black, and mine were all white, except for two little strips in the middle. And those were the reason I'm sure I wasn't on a respirator.
Exactly. You were strong.
I imagine just about everything in your lives has changed because of COVID and because of ALS. Becca, let me ask you to describe where you are physically now in relationship to the ALS.
I've been wheelchair bound since March, so, you know, 7 months or so. I'm progressing. My limbs aren't working. My hands aren't working. I have no diaphragm, so it's a little bit hard for me to speak loudly.
Yeah, she's using a voice amplifier right now.
Yeah, so you can hear me. I sleep with a BiPAP machine to help me breathe better while I sleep. But, you know, I still have a lot of health inside me. And so I'm pushing forward to find a cure.
Right.
Find a drug that will help me.
She's the strongest person I know.
Oh.
Was Moulin Rouge the first show to go dark because there was a case of suspected COVID in the production?
Actually, it was. We had an unusual schedule. We had Thursday matinees, and we knew that that people were getting sick all around us, but we didn't know in the company that anyone was sick or anyone in the building was sick or suspected of being ill. And we all got a text at around 12:30, the normal time for a show to start, for a matinee to start at 2:00. And we got a text from our producers that said, come to the house and we're gonna have an emergency meeting at 1:00. And so literally everybody in the building had to be there, stagehands, the ushers, the house manager. And they said, one of our cast members has taken ill and he's at the doctor right now. And it was suspected that he might have COVID. And so to be proactive and to make sure nobody else got sick, they were gonna cancel the matinee and evening show, and they were going to sterilize everything that they could. And I really applaud our producers for taking that step before any other show did. Mm-hmm. And they canceled the show, and nobody knew that they were gonna cancel the show. Even the house manager said, there's a whole line of people waiting outside to come in. The line goes around the block. And he was just told to tell them that an emergency has come up and we're very sorry, but the show is canceled today. And later on that afternoon, Governor Cuomo actually canceled all of the Broadway shows.
That very day, yeah.
Yeah, that very day, that evening, for a month.
And how soon after that did you get COVID, Danny?
I think a week later, I was a little over, like 9 days later, I was in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Were you afraid to go to the hospital thinking like, well, maybe I don't have COVID, but I'll be exposed to it if I do go?
Well, I had a feeling I might have it. And I tried to get a test, and that took a week and a half to finally come through. But I felt ill, and my doctors kept telling me, if you don't have trouble breathing, don't go to the hospital, because right now the hospitals are dangerous places to actually go. So I was holding on. I was sick and I had fever and I was trying to stay away from Becca as much as I could. And our son Zach was here with us at the time. And I wasn't feeling good and I decided to take a shower in the evening, one evening. And I went into the shower and I couldn't breathe and I fell to my knees in the shower. And a voice just came out of me that said, "Guys, I need to go to the hospital." And it just literally came out of me. And that voice, that decision saved my life because my lungs were so bad. If I hadn't gone, you know, it probably would have been worse. Because I just kept getting worse. And then my son, Zach, walked me to the hospital, St. Luke's, which is about a block and a half away. And he was looking back at me the whole time, you know, so worried about me. And, you know, as a parent, all you want to do is take care of your children, you know, desperately take care of your children and not have them worry. And to see that look in his eyes, that worry for me and him walking me to the hospital was quite a reversal and quite emotional for me. But they took me in right away and I got great care there. And I'm very grateful to everybody in that building.
If you don't mind my asking, I think you have just such a beautiful voice. I love your singing so much. And I know it's hard for you just to have enough breath to talk right now. And as recently as June, there was a Zoom event for you related to ALS and raising awareness about it. And you sung three songs in that and sounded gorgeous. So I can hear that, you know, in terms of your voice and the breath that you need for voice, that's progressed. Are there songs that go through your mind now, even if you can't really sing them?
Oh, yeah. And we listen to me sometimes, you know, recordings. And that's lovely. So, you know, I'm proud of what I've done.
There's a type of immortality that we were talking about the other day that Becca's recordings give her. And she was expressing how proud she is of those recordings. So, and they are, they're glorious. They are.
I agree. Why don't we pause and listen to one?
Yay.
So I'd like you, Becca, to choose one that you'd particularly like to hear, especially if it's a song that has special meaning for you now or that's taken on a new meaning for you.
I was going to suggest My White Knight.
Say a few words about why you love this song and then we'll hear it.
I was just going to say that Danny's my white knight. So
here's Rebecca Luker from the Broadway revival of The Music Man singing My White Knight.
My white knight, not a Lancelot, nor an angel with wings, just someone to love me, who is not ashamed of a few nice things. My white knight, what my heart would say if it only knew how. Please, dear Venus, show me now. All I want is a plain man. All I want is a modest man, a quiet man, a gentleman, a straightforward and honest man to sit with me in a cottage somewhere in the state of Iowa, and I would like him to be more interested in me than he is in himself, and more interested in us than in me. And if occasionally he'd ponder what makes Shakespeare and Beethoven great, him I could love till I die. Him I could love
That was Rebecca Luker singing My White Knight from the musical The Music Man. And this is from a Broadway revival of the show. And that is such a beautiful recording, and grateful to have it.
It was one of my favorite parts of the show.
Yeah. I always think it must be so hard to have something that you're so gifted at that you can't do anymore.
Right. Yeah, it's hard. Sorry.
Yeah, that's been especially hard on Becca, on all of us who know Rebecca. And but I will say that there are some days she has actually no voice at all. And then it comes back and she fights hard and she, you know, perseveres. There are many different things that we have to mourn along the way, but we also, it also teaches us something, and we adapt because it seems like every few weeks we're adapting to a new reality with this illness.
Yeah.
You know, everybody says it's very, very hard to be a patient, but it's also very hard to be a caregiver. And it can also, when in a couple, when one person needs care and the spouse is the caregiver, it can be a very loving, tender thing. It can also create a lot of impatience with each other. And if you're comfortable talking about it, because so many people are going through or have gone through or will go through this kind of thing, if there's anything you're comfortable sharing about the tenderness and the pressures when somebody is sick and the spouse becomes the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel like I haven't really slept in 7 or 8 months.
Right.
I laugh, but I say that in all honesty. It's exhausting and not easy. And I've been helping to take care of Becca now for a year and a half since the onset of the illness. You know, having said that, of course, there are the beautiful things that this kind of a situation presents you with. The closeness, the friendship, the deep understanding, the trust, and it's a privilege. And I mean that it is a great, great privilege to share this time together. Having said that, it's exhausting.
Yes.
It is exhausting, and sometimes we are at each other because, you know, we're still a normal married couple.
Yeah.
Just going through this kind of a awful, bizarre situation.
Right. But,
you know, we still, you know, bicker and laugh and kiss and, you know, all the normal things that everybody else goes through. It's just that everything is heightened because of the situation, because of the illness and the sheer exhaustion of it all.
As hard as this is for me, I sometimes think that Danny has the harder job. So that should tell you something.
It's
tough.
It is tough. You're constantly on the phone with doctors, with OTs, with
insurance.
PTs, with a reflexology, with insurance companies, and you know, your home health aide. And we're so grateful to everybody who has stepped up and
yes,
helped us
are.
Out.
You know who you are. We love you.
Just a few months ago in June, when you had a little more breath, before the ALS had advanced to the point where it is now, you did a Zoom event to raise awareness about ALS, and you sang a Jerome Kern song called Not You, that's also on your Jerome Kern album. And I thought, since we're talking about your voice, that we might hear a little bit of that. And so if you could maybe compare for us what the song means in context, and in the context of the show that it's from, but what the song with what the song means personally to you now.
Oh, I just think it's one of the most beautiful early Kern songs ever. Sondheim said he liked it too, so that's good. what it means to me. I just think it's one of the most beautiful Kern ballads ever. And Kern just speaks to me so well, you know. I feel like it's I was meant to sing Kern.
So this is Rebecca Luker, recorded in June, singing the Jerome Kern song, Not You.
I used to think that men were all the same and different only as to name. I used to think that sentiment was nothing more than accident, and that things just were, that they had to occur, and no one was to blame. But now I know that they are not the same, that love is somewhere in the game. There's a certain someone, and I'm anxious he should hear me. Who? You. Always has me worried and in trouble when he's near me. Who?
That was my guest, Rebecca Luker, recorded in June, singing the Jerome Kern song, Not You. And in the months since then, her ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, has progressed. And at this point, Becca, you're saying you can't really sing anymore, or you don't have enough breath or diaphragm support to do that.
Right.
Sadly for you and for all of us who love your singing. Thank you so much for this conversation and for sharing so much with us.
Thank you.
Lovely talking to you, Terry.
Broadway stars Danny Burstein and Rebecca Luker speaking with Terry Gross. The musician David Byrne took his theatrical concert, American Utopia, to Broadway last October for a short run, closing on February 16th. That live show has now been made into a film directed by Spike Lee, which premieres this weekend on HBO. Our critic at large, John Power, says the show's optimistic high spirits offer some relief from what's been a very rough year.
Back when the Nazis were running roughshod over his homeland, Bertolt Brecht wrote a short poem that asked, "In the dark times, will there still be singing?" And it gave a reply, "Yes, there will be singing about the dark times." Of course, there are many ways of singing about darkness. One is to celebrate hope. That's what's on offer in HBO's David Byrne's American Utopia, a joyous blend of song, dance, and revival meeting. Capturing a live performance of the acclaimed Broadway show, the film was directed by Spike Lee. Now, Spike might not be the first person you'd expect to click with Byrne, a guy I don't exactly picture yelling courtside at a Knicks game. Yet Lee is terrific at filming live performances, and his swooping, shrewdly observant camera meshes perfectly with Byrne's layered and rousing sense of musical theater. This is one show you can dance to. American Utopia starts with Byrne, barefoot in a silver-gray suit, holding a model of the brain and pondering different ideas of connection. He's gradually joined by his equally barefoot co-stars, also uniformed in silver-gray suits, who sing, dance, and play handheld instruments as they do nearly 20 Byrne songs, from his Talking Heads classics to his more recent solo work. Thanks to wireless technology, everyone moves around the stage in seemingly total freedom. Byrne's work has long been obsessed with the many ways of being imprisoned, in oneself, in an addiction to things, in a meaningless life, and equally attuned to different forms of escape. American Utopia features a series of songs that ask questions about the meaning of home. The answers range from the welcoming good spirits of Everybody's Coming to My House to the rowdier energies found in this rendition of Talking Heads' party song, Burning Down the House.
Ah, what
In fact, the show isn't actually about burning anything down. It's about conjuring an image of an American utopia. You'll be relieved to hear that Byrne isn't hectoring. Yes, he gives a little speech about the need to vote, but he doesn't say who for. And yes, Byrne points out that many of his cast members are immigrants, as is he, a naturalized American born in Scotland. Yet his vision of utopia is not any kind of political program. It's the show itself. For Byrne, utopia is about embracing difference. It's about men and women from diverse races and cultures coming together to create something new, alive, and beautiful that helps people connect. While Byrne starts alone on the stage, by the grand finale, he and his co-stars are marching through the aisles, singing the cheery song, Road to Nowhere. Everybody's together on screen, even the audience. In a way, the show echoes Byrne's own artistic transformation. Back in his early post-punk days, he was almost a parody of the nerdy, angst-riddled white guy. With his onstage tics and spasms, he seemed a bit like Psycho's Norman Bates. If Norman hadn't turned into his dead mother, but instead gone to art school. What liberated him seems to have been his encounter with black music. Byrne's persona became sunnier and more communal, as you could see in Jonathan Demme's great 1984 concert film Stop Making Sense, where Byrne and his fellow talking heads exude sheer collective joy. Now, the skeptic in me feels obliged to note one limitation of the show's communitarian notion of utopia. Byrne writes and sings lead on all the songs. He's obviously the star. Everybody else plays second fiddle. And while they clearly enjoy performing, I suspect being a backup is not how they view utopia. Yet if Byrne doesn't always rise above stardom's privilege, he's attuned to other ways he's privileged. He realizes that the show's upbeat vibe could easily turn into feel-good kitsch that feels disconnected from present-day reality. So he puts some political steel in the show's spine by including a startling rendition of the Janelle Monáe protest song, Hell You Tombout, whose lyrics are basically the names of African Americans who've died at police hands or from racial violence. This powerful song is political in a way that Byrne's talk about voting is not. Yet its presence offers a necessary reminder that any utopia begins in a world that is painfully far from perfect. You can only sing yourself through the dark times if you don't forget how dark they can be.
John Powers is our critic at large. He reviewed David Byrne's American Utopia, which premieres this weekend on HBO. Next, we're going to listen to Terry's interview with Hannah Jaffe Walt. You may know her work as a producer and reporter on This American Life. Jaffe Walt has a new 5-part podcast dealing with racial inequity in our public school system, focusing specifically on problems caused by white parents who say they want their kids to go to schools with diversity. The series, called Nice White Parents, is the latest season of Serial. Along with Nicole Hannah-Jones, Jaffe Walt won a Peabody Award for their 2015 reporting on This American Life on education and school segregation. Her current podcast, Nice White Parents, focuses on a middle and high school formerly known as the School for International Studies in the gentrifying Brooklyn neighborhood Cobble Hill. Before gentrification, the students were black and brown kids from poor and working class families. When white parents started sending their kids to the school, Jaffe Walt found the school's priorities changed to suit the needs of the white kids from homes with more money. And some white parents and students thought that a bad school was being made better by their presence. It's a point Jaffe Walt makes in the first episode, taking us on a tour of the school.
And down in the library, I met 3 sixth grade boys, white boys, new to SAS. They're sweaty from playing soccer and looking very small against their huge backpacks. These boys, even at 11 years old, they've absorbed the same messages. That SAS wasn't so good before. It was a bad school.
The kids wouldn't pay attention, and they had, like, got to, like, zone out every little thing. And I bet they learned very little. And now this generation with us, I think we're doing a lot better, and I think that we're learning at a much faster pace.
He and his friends, they've turned the school around. That's what he's learning.
It's going to be one of, like, the top choices, like, already in, like, the book. Like when you're applying to middle schools, you get, like, a book sort of, like, on statuses and stuff. And I think this school is actually, like, really high up in the statuses.
Nobody calls it the book on statuses. They call it a directory of schools, with info like enrollment numbers for different schools, test scores, and special programs. But I love that he calls it the book on statuses, because this is what happened at SIS. The school had a bad reputation among white families, and then suddenly it was in demand. Its status had changed because of the white kids. A powerful draw for white families into any school is other white families. When there are enough other white families in a school, you reach what one study calls a bliss point. This is a real thing researchers study. How many white kids are needed at a school to make other white families feel comfortable? That number, the bliss point, is 26%. That fall, white families were crowding the school tours at SIS. Not because the test scores had improved. The new scores hadn't even come out yet. But because the other white families made them feel blissfully comfortable.
Hannah Jaffe Walt, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on Nice White Parents. We should start by acknowledging that a lot of students are doing remote learning now and the meaning of school has just kind of changed since the pandemic. So let's start by acknowledging that.
Yeah, my two are home.
Right. So what we just heard, is the bliss point something you heard reflected by other white parents?
Yeah, I mean, nobody used that term, but I think so much of the conversation that parents have about schools uses sort of proxy language when it comes to race in particular. I mean, the things that parents talk to one another about is test scores or programming or, like, is that school safe or the pedagogy, which obviously, and the school test scores, obviously all very important questions when you're looking at a school. But it's pretty rare that you'll hear parents talk about the race of the kids who are in a school when they're searching for a school to choose. I think that's especially true of white parents. And even though we know that race influences parent choice in school, and you can see that in places where there is a lot of racial diversity, like the neighborhood around this school, the schools can still remain segregated. I think white parents are pretty savvy at evading the explicit conversation around race, although it's clearly shaping our thoughts about schools.
Your series examines, you know, this whole idea of diversity in the school from two different points of view. One from the white parents looking for diversity for their schools, for their children, and the other from the parents of the, you know, Black and Latino children who were already attending the school and see this more as like gentrification. Like the white, wealthier people are moving in and changing the priorities to suit their needs and not the needs of the children who were already here. And also in terms of the dual perspective on this, the white parents that you report on see like diversity as a real priority. For the Black parents and the parents of Latino kids, of Latinx kids, they just want better schools. And they think that the better schools shouldn't necessarily require the presence of white students and the activities of white parents. Eve Ewing, who has, she's a sociologist who writes about public schools in America, she asked you at one point, why are you so obsessed with the idea of integration? What did her question do for you in terms of making you think about what integration means?
It was a super helpful question, and I really remember the moment that that she posed it, because we were talking for, you know, several hours of kind of laying out the story for her, and the assumption that integration was a goal was sort of shot through everything that we were talking about. And so I remember when she said, like, what is it that obsesses you? Why are you obsessed with integration? It took me aback, I think, because I have taken as an assumption in my own life and also in my reporting that, you know, integration is good, and integration is good partially because segregation is anathema to the American promise, and that it's a part of the mission of public schools, that schools be places where kids of different backgrounds come together and develop, you know, what Horace Mann called fellow feeling and connection to one another. And I think Eve led me sort of down a path of really just trying to understand better what it, where integration comes from, where the push for integration comes from. The push for integration in almost all early integration cases come from a desire for equal resources and equal access and equal opportunity. And that doesn't have much to do with sitting next to white kids in a classroom or, you know, benefiting from the presence of white kids. It is really about, yeah, access to quality education. And it's a means to an end. It's not the goal in and of itself. And I think integration in my mind and in the mind of, I think, a lot of progressive white parents has been turned into kind of a virtue in and of itself.
The school that you reported on, the School for International Studies, this wasn't the first time that white parents were interested in the school and creating an integrated school in the neighborhood. You found a folder with letters from parents dating back to 1963, when the school was known as Intermediate School 293, and it was in the process of being built. And so what were some of the common themes in 1963 from the white parents who were writing letters to the city saying they wanted the school to be integrated?
The most familiar thing was the way white parents were talking about integration. And in the 60s, it was integration. And I think in 2015, the word was more diversity. But the letters, I mean, the letters felt to me really, I was really surprised to find them and felt sort of startling to imagine that there had been white parents in this neighborhood when the school was being planned who were surrounded by a civil rights movement and a kind of Black-led movement for liberation and civil rights, and had said, we want to be on the right side of history. We want to be part of this movement. We want to have an integrated school. And you, Board of Education, you're planning to build it in a place where it will inevitably be segregated. And you should put it closer to the middle of the two segregated neighborhoods so that it can be integrated, so that we can send our kids there and be part of integration. I think in reading the letters, it wasn't as clear, but in talking to the parents, it was definitely clear that the ideas about integration then were very similar to the ideas about integration in 2015, that it was about a racial togetherness and harmony, and that there was a sort of inherent virtue and value in just putting people in the same building with each other, and that that itself was a worthy effort.
One of the things that you found is, because you called a lot of the white parents who had written these letters, mm-hmm. and the parents who you spoke to did not end up sending their kids to the school, even though they had pushed for the integrated school. Why didn't they send their children?
I heard a lot of different reasons about why people didn't send their kids. Some people left the city. And the school was being planned in the early 60s and opened in the late 60s. And so some of these parents had very young kids when they wrote these letters and joined the increasing number of people moving to the suburbs before their kids were old enough to have gone to a junior high school. And many parents who did stay in Brooklyn sent their kids to private schools.
I want to play a clip with one of the women who pushed for an integrated school and ended up not sending her child there. And she had been a public school teacher who taught in an integrated elementary school until she had her own children. Her name is Elaine Henke, and you spoke to her by phone, and here's what she had to say.
I mean, one of the problems is that many of the white kids had higher sort of academic skills or skills. They could read better. I think, if the white kids knew how to read in first grade, and I guess there were black kids who also could, but it just seemed as if most of the black kids, you know, didn't really learn to read.
Part of the vocal complaints of black parents at this period of time was that their kids were not learning how to read because schools were segregated and their kids were kept in schools that were inferior. And that was part of the argument for integration.
Yes. Yes.
That their kids were not going to get the resources and quality teaching and good facilities unless they were in the same buildings with kids like yours.
Right. I don't know what to say to that. I guess I began to feel that things were really difficult for these kids. Schools were not made for them. If the schools were made for them, with their background, what would they be like? I think there was, and that's another whole thing, I don't know about it. I think there was sort of anger in the black community, at the white community. A lot of the teachers were white.
Mm-hmm.
There were more white teachers, I suppose. People said that that was racism, and of course it was racism, but maybe the kids were a little angry at the school. I couldn't fault them for that. But on the other hand, then they don't get as much from the school. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the problems were kind of enormous. And I guess I just, at one point, I decided that my kids should go. I went to Brooklyn Friends. And, I mean, we could afford to pay for it. It wasn't easy. I mean, you know, it was. But
did your feelings about integration change? Like, did you believe in it less?
Maybe. I think I would have said no theoretically, but maybe they did. I guess I saw it as a more difficult project then. I did back off from it. I didn't.
Yeah. It felt when you guys wrote these letters like this is, integration is this exciting ideal and we can be part of it and it's going to be a meaningful project that's also going to be kind of easy.
I certainly didn't think it would be so difficult. But I was innocent, you know. I don't know. I still believe in it. I do.
When she says that I was innocent, you think she really meant I was naive?
Yeah, yeah. And I think she was. And I think a lot of progressive white parents, nice white parents, have shared this with her. I definitely recognized myself in what Elaine was describing as a sort of attachment to this ideal of racial togetherness and a desire for that to happen without it asking much of me or costing me much.
What were some of the hardest things for you in getting people to talk honestly with you about race? I think for a lot of people, it's really, and maybe particularly for white people, it's difficult to talk about race and racial inequity.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely was more difficult with white people. I did not have the same problem getting lots of people of color to talk to me, although there was like a question of what I was doing and who I was. But I think that there was much more comfort in those conversations. I think partly I had to work really hard on being direct. I mean, the conversation that you played with Elaine, who was the only person who wrote letters in the 1960s who actually looked at the school and seemed like she was truly committed to this some idea of integration and wanted to send her kids there and didn't. You know, we spoke once and I listened back and was like, whoa, I totally chickened out. Like, I was just a coward in that conversation and didn't ask her directly all these things that I was wondering. And I myself didn't kind of have the comfort to have conversations with other white people about the choices that we make. I think I was much more practiced at the conversation about schools where you say like, yeah, we wanted to go there, but it was just so chaotic and we couldn't. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah, get it. And you move on, you know, and just sort of accept the ways in which we excuse ourselves from our commitments and obligations to schools so easily. So I think in part, I just had to really work on explicitly naming a lot of the thoughts that I was having in my head and questions that I was having in my head and feeling more comfortable asking them and following up when somebody said something that like kind of made sense but sort of felt like a little bit of a shield.
Well, thank you so much, Hannah, for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Chana Jaffe-Walt is a producer for This American Life. Her five-part series, Nice White Parents, is the latest season of the podcast serial, which is now part of the New York Times. She spoke with Terry Gross.